Session number 6245, reel 4.
Mr. Richards, reel 4. Continuing our discussion about raising morale, how exactly did the committee and others organise more formally entertainment to maintain reasonable spirits?
Formal entertainment was not very frequent. The British Other Ranks had a band. They had a set of drums and a trumpet and either a trombone or something. Anyway, had three instruments, and they did remarkably well with it. There were other people who could sing solos and so on. Some of the officers and some of the ladies could sing, and there was several camp concerts for the camp in general, not particular sections of it.
Where were these held?
Out in the main square, in the middle of the camp, not outside the camp, and in the open air, of course. There was one good trooper who dressed up as a woman. He looked very nice too. And there was one lady who sang Land of Hope and Glory and the famous song from
Madam Butterfly,
yes, with the Japanese sitting in the front row. But most of our entertainment was within our own section.
Sorry, could I catch up for a moment? How often were the, can you remember the number of these general camp entertainments and when they were?
No, I don't remember the number. Probably only two or three. And we had concerts inside our own sections. Some people put on little plays. In fact, plays were written.
On paper supplied by Japanese?
Either that or learned. We hadn't got much in the way of paper. We used tobacco wrappings and things of that sort. Sometimes, of course, we found tobacco wrapped up in our own court records. I remember finding one that listed the guilt of a Japanese shipmaster who was ostensibly fishing, but was believed to be spying, as indeed he was, must have been, and he was fined for entering territorial waters or something, and this was duly recorded. This piece of paper turned up wrapped around a bit of tobacco that we have to buy. The Archdeacon from Archdeacon Mercer from North Borneo was a musician. He had written a setting of the communion service in Chinese, fitting the Chinese terms, which I believe is still used. And he wrote largely from memory all kinds of things. He wrote out anthems for us, hymn tunes, probably the wrong harmonies, but they worked. We had 7 to 12 male voices for a choir to keep the Sunday services going. And some made musical instruments. We had a couple of violins and I think a bass that's the string of which was barbed wire with the barb stripped off. Ukuleles made on coconut shells, and a few bass voices to fill it out. And we produced, we played bits of Cavalleria Rusticana, all kinds of things with these instruments. But then the Japanese said no more than 10 people should gather together at any one place or time. So we couldn't hold any more concerts after that.
Do you remember approximately when this regulation came in? Towards the start?
No. Mm. No, it was, must have been probably in 1943, but I don't remember the date. So we went in for all the other amusements that were available. Lectures, in particular. People were lecturing on their own particular subject all over the place. Ones I attended and remember best were by Noel Turner, who would lie on the floor in the dark when everybody is in his own place and lecture on English history. And he did this for about 6 months at least, and he covered from 1066 to the present day, all out of his head. And he's still doing it. He goes on tour about Great Britain looking at old castles and things. But there were lots of others, and there were language studies. People were learning various languages. I don't think anybody except Salu ever learned any Japanese. But there were people learning various dialects of Chinese and Dutch. Of course, we had Dutch people with us, so that was easy. People trying to practice their French. We had a German dentist. He was teaching German, and so on. There was a lot of it going on. I sat at the feet of the Archdeacon and learned what very little I know about music, theory of. We had books. I'd taken in. I had a copy of the Bible, like everybody else, and a copy of Virgil, which I found was all right when I'd read it three times. I could understand it without translating it. But there was a lawyer who had retired to a small island off Labuan, Lawyer Johnson, who had a tremendous collection of Shakespeare, books about Shakespeare, about the Elizabethan period and so on. Must have been several hundred of them. And for some reason, they were all brought down to the camp. So they could be shared out and passed around and exchanged between the different camps, so that we got to know quite a lot about Shakespeare one way and another. To such good effect that I find in the notes I made in my passport about Virgil that there are cross-references to some lines and some passages in Shakespeare's plays. We got as close as that. I also made a chess set out of durian fruit wood, carved with a penknife. I've still got it, but I don't think it was much used. Digby had a portable chess set, and he used to play games with one of the Dutch fathers across the wire. They used to make one move a week, because it's not safe to pass things through the wire all the time. I mean, either a week or one in 24 hours, something like that. And at a given time, this thing would be passed through, and you would have the next 24 hours to consider your move. The paper we used was scrounged from various sources. As I said, it's mostly tobacco wrappings and things of that sort. Some few people had a little paper. And the blank pages and the fly leaves of books got used. Somehow paper was obtained, or subscribed rather, to set up our own newspaper called Adversity. it didn't go on for very long, either because there were no contributions or the paper ran out. I don't know which. Four of the five copies still exist and are in Kuching, I believe.
How would you describe morale in general over the 3 years? Do you think it went in periods of depression and renewal? How do you see it overall?
It changed with the individual, but I don't think that mattered much because we were so mixed up, so closely mixed up together. I think morale was always fairly good because we had this organization of a kind, and I think in our heart of hearts we never really lost any hope, lost hope. The thing was to survive without being selfish, and in the end we believed, well, we didn't talk about it, that we would get out, as we did.
Would you say there was a general level of anxiety that you lived with, or was it more resigned?
Well, from my own point of view, I was a bachelor at the time, so I had no family ties, so I suppose it was easier for me than for some of the others, particularly the chaps in North Borneo, who were separated from their wives and families, who were just a little way down the road.
What sort of contact did they have with their family?
They were allowed to meet and talk together by the roadside once a week or something like that. And we used to give them a quarter of all our garden produce that we grew. But it must have been an anxious time for the men and their wives, if they had any, of course. Whereas I had, well, I mean, my parents was all I had so long, far away, that it wasn't present with me. I think also the deterioration in our rations, and therefore in our conditions, over the 3 years helped us in some way, because we achieved a kind of apathy, which you could dignify as fatalism, if you like. So that we didn't react in the same way. Good news, bad news. Oh, yes. No. And a trivial instance of it is surprised by the Japanese. The sentries would be inclined to go on patrol through the sections of the camp sometimes, usually just after dark or some awkward time like that. And they all wore rubber boots. Didn't always hear them coming. And you would suddenly hear the stamp of feet inside your hut and the crash of a rifle butt. First man to react, obviously, of course, was liable to get questioned or slapped or something. So I should think easily by the beginning of 1943, nobody reacted. You just waited 30 seconds and then looked slowly around. And it was that sort of non-reaction that I think helped us. I mean, even if the news was disastrous, it would still be, oh yes.
Yes, that certainly sounds like a survival tactic. Were there any people whom you knew or heard of who nevertheless went into periods of acute depression? And if so, what sort of facilities were available to treat them?
I can't think of any in present terms. But people who did get at all despondent, if they started to mope, would, and they could never hide the fact for 5 minutes. And if you've only got 4 feet of bed space each, your neighbour knows what's happening to you. He can't help it. And he can do something about it. Or he knows somebody who will. So we had, after all, we had a pretty good cross-section of ages, seniorities, and occupations in each hut. Although we tended to congregate all Sarawak together and all North and so on. Within my own hut, for instance, we had the bishop, the archdeacon, and another Anglican priest. I don't think we had any Roman Catholics, no. There was a school teacher, a Dutch banker, Dutch district officer, rubber planter from North Borneo, timberman from Sarawak, 3 or 4 district officers and a resident, and this Chinese expert, Salu, and several more. And that was all in one hut. So somebody would have tipped off the senior officer or the bishop, or as appropriate, if anything had looked like happening.
Do you think the lack of relationships with the opposite sex had any effect on morale?
Don't think so. I remember some, one or two complaining in the early days in the first camp that they felt a bit deprived. But it didn't. I suppose it's the beginning of this apathy business. We were, after all, clean locked away in what amounted to a monastic establishment.
Mm. There weren't, as a result, any incidents of homosexuality that you know of.
Not that came to light. Mm. Not that I know of.
If they had come to light, what do you think the reaction would have been of, say, the committee, or perhaps more generally amongst
the
yourselves?
I don't know. They'd have probably separated them. I don't know what they'd have done about it. Mm. And for all I know, there was, but I never met it. Certainly by the end of 1943, nobody was that interested.
Because of the state of health and the tactics, so to speak. Mm. Turning briefly to health now. You gave me, I think, when I last spoke to you, your change in body weight as an indication of the state of your health.
Mm. I went down from about 10 stone to 8 stone 3. I was never very weighty, so I didn't lose so much as other people. There were some who went down from 16 stone to 10, and of course that hit them a lot harder. It's the proportion that they lost was much bigger. But it, some of the hard drinkers and overweight, overeating characters, of course, were probably benefited by internment up to a point. I remember that there was a couple who were rubber planting, who came in. I think the man was about 16 stone and his wife was 14, something like that, when they came into internment. And they lost a lot of weight, both of them. They were quite slim. So that the man could hand over a pair of his pre-war shorts, khaki shorts, to his wife, to have it made into two pairs of shorts. Which he then wore out.
What medical facilities were available for a range of likely accidents?
There was a so-called hospital, but it was fairly devoid of drugs and
surgical equipment.
Surgical equipment, as far as I know. Fortunately, I never got in there. There was even less for the troops than there was for us. There was a store of acromycin, I remember, but it was very diluted.
Who administered it?
I think it was doled out by the doctors of the camp, who were doing a kind of roster in the hospital under a Japanese who didn't know anything. But it was, you were really almost on your own. You might get some of this diluted acromycin, and then we had no bandages for cuts and wounds and things. Except this faithful old banana fibre, which you could beat out into a kind of bandage-sized strip and wrap it round the wound, but it went hard and scratchy unless you kept it wet. Which again, of course, didn't do the wound any good.
Did you have a dentist on camp?
Yes, he was a refugee German Jew. He had been in the German army long before, I think, so he was a bit military-minded, but he was very good.
What equipment did he have?
One pair of forceps only, as far as I know. So all he could do was to draw teeth if they were troublesome. He did one of mine, which was a molar, with, well, I don't know what, he had something that he injected, but I think he said it was very old or very dilute, so it didn't seem to work much. The best bet was an American dentist who would whip a tooth out while he looked at it.
But what sort of opportunity did you have to contact him?
American dentist? Oh, he was an internee from, I don't know where from, Jefferson probably, North Borneo, I think.
Do you know if there were any extra facilities for women and children? Or differences in facilities?
I don't know, I don't think so, but there would have been, I don't even know whether there was a woman doctor about. But between them, there must have been somebody who knew a thing or two. And as the nuns would have known, too, because a lot of the missions ran hospitals. So the nuns would have been a tower of strength in that respect.
Did you feel that you were likely to suffer from any, let's say, vitamin deficiency? The loss of weight obviously must have included that sort of hazard.
Well, the loss of weight was simply lack of food. Yes, we knew that we would suffer from deficiency diseases, and we did. We knew quite a lot about deficiency diseases by the time we were finished.
Can you,
we could distinguish between two different sorts of beriberi. One is the dry one, which is painful, and the other one is the one that is not painful at all, but your feet swell. And if you lie on your back and put your feet up, the swelling goes down just as you watch it, just like pouring water from one end of a plastic bag to the other. It's quite extraordinary. And one of the specific cures for it is half a pint of peanuts a day. You needn't eat anything else.
But presumably they were not available.
No.
Were there any cures for?
Well, we had to, if somebody got badly afflicted that way, we we would probably try to bring them around by giving them extra special or something or anything that we happen to have. We did grow some peanuts, but not many.
The Japanese made no provision for deficiency diseases of any sort.
Oh, no. Mm. And, of course, they increased the affliction of other diseases. I mean, there were one or two people who did die, whether from beriberi alone or beriberi and a recurrence of malaria or something. Wiped all that just like that.
There was no quinine available.
Not that I remember. Maybe. Mm. And we got these sores, of course, these jungle sores that grow yellow and then green in the middle. Some of them get as big as half crowns. But we cured that, mostly cured that towards the, well, I suppose it must have been early 45, the Japanese produced some flowers of sulfur in rancid coconut oil. A lovely mix. Rotten eggs and rotten coconut. And this was dished out and we smeared ourselves all over with it and then did each other's backs. And it did clear it up. But it was a pretty horrendous sort of treatment. You went around in this oily smokes. Well, we were all in the same boat. It didn't matter, I suppose.
How were the deaths in the camp treated by the Japanese?
The Japanese were very good about deaths. They, in common with the Chinese, I suppose, regarded as the individual as expendable. But once he was dead, then they paid due respect, I suppose, because they're ancestor worshippers. That's probably not the right term, but anyway, they do respect their ancestors. Family history is very important. So that whenever there was a funeral, the Japanese would, all the sentries along the route would bow deeply as the people passed and so on. They didn't interfere with it in any way.
Were you aware that there were more incidents of death amongst particular sections?
Oh, yes. Well, in the early days, they started by allowing us to use our own cemeteries in the town.